As far as I'm concerned, part of deploying the National Guard to DC when there was absolutely not an emergency was to change the conversation away from Epstein. Hello, everyone, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All to Sarah. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and we're back. We're back. George,
we're back.
It's great to see you. I cannot believe how much illegal news we have to cover.
Did anything happen this morning or in the last 10 minutes?
Guys, I gotta tell you, I woke up to 1,000 text messages from George. He's just been,
This happened at 1 a.m. This happened at 2 a.m.
Have you slept? I was looking at the text message the time they came in. It was like the middle of the night.
I'm in New York City. I got in late and I had all this stuff because I was traveling that I wanted to read and catch up on, like literally like 6 or 7 judicial decisions that have come down in just the past week and two or three of them the last 3 days. And I was staying up trying to read them all. And I can't say that I met with a lot of success, but I think I know enough to talk about this for a bit.
Well, I'm glad. I'm going to try to move. There really is a lot of content. And so I want to try to move somewhat expeditiously through it because I think this is going to be an action-packed episode. And I guess I'll just say this is the first time George and I have been together in a little while. I took the summer off from this pod and from the focus group pod. I missed you too. I have a special project I've been working on. So it's don't yet. People acted like I took a big vacation somewhere. I took one vacation, took my kids to Disney, but otherwise I've been working on lots of stuff. But we are back. Original team, here we go. Yesterday, the survivors of Epstein and Maxwell's abuse held a press conference telling their stories and calling on Congress to pass the Epstein Files Transparency Act. This comes a few weeks after DOJ released the transcript from an interview between Ghislaine Maxwell and Todd Blanche, formerly Trump's personal lawyer and now deputy attorney general. She did the interview in exchange for limited immunity. She also got transferred to a minimum security prison. Okay, so George, I know you read the transcript. I have not. Tell me if we learned anything interesting. And also, just as a note, is it normal for like the deputy AG to be interviewing a witness?
No. It's so irregular. I mean, there's so many irregular aspects about this. I mean, first of all, you don't normally interview somebody who's already been sentenced to jail, okay? Unless they have something new and different to tell you and they're trying to get leniency. And she's kind of trying to do that here, but this isn't in the regular sense of getting leniency because I'm finally willing to tell you what the boss told me to do, right? The boss is dead here. Epstein's dead. There's nobody she can point the finger to. That really matters at this point, although she could say unhelpful things to Trump. And the other irregular aspect is none of the people who were involved in prosecuting her, who actually know the record of the case, who investigated the case, who drafted the indictments, who presented the materials before the grand jury, who selected through the hundreds of victims to figure out what 4 witnesses they were going to put this woman away with. None of those people are involved. In fact, the government not too long ago fired one of the lead attorneys on the case, the lead attorney on the case, a very talented lawyer named Maureen.
Was it
Comey?
Comey?
Comey, yes, Comey. Yeah. So there may have been some other stuff going on there. But she would know best. I mean, she would be the one who would be able to extract information from her, particularly because one of the things you would do when you're interviewing a criminal, somebody who you, the government, have previously argued is a perjurer. They argued when in sentencing and in other circumstances that she perjured herself. Ghislaine Maxwell perjured herself in connection with civil litigation against Jeffrey Epstein, which kind of got all of this rolling decades ago. You know, you want somebody who knows the factual record, who knows what the investigation shows, because you need to test the witness's credibility. Of course, they did not do that here. Instead, they have Todd Blanche, the deputy attorney general. Deputy attorney generals don't do this. They're administered. They don't usually even argue in court. Sometimes they might get one case in the Supreme Court if they really want to do it for fun. But they don't really do day-to-day stuff. They manage. They make policy decisions. If a really, really important critical indictment comes down or is about to be proffered by a U.S. attorney's office to be presented to a grand jury. And it involved, I don't know, a United States senator or a foreign, some kind of a foreign person that has potential foreign policy issues. I mean, yeah, sometimes that stuff goes all the way up there. But to interview a witness is absolutely insane. And then who is Todd Blanche? How did Todd Blanche get to be Todd Blanche, Deputy Attorney General of the United States? He was a criminal defense lawyer. Okay, he was also a prosecutor. But the most important credential he has, he was a criminal defense lawyer for
Donald Trump.
Yes, good guess, excellent. And he was, you know, who was convicted of 34 counts in this city. So, I mean, it's just freaking bizarre. And then other bizarre aspects of it: this woman is a convicted child molester and trafficker. Okay, she got, I don't know what, 20 years? She got a stiff sentence. And, you know, they don't put child molesters in Club Fed, but she got transferred to Club Fed right after this interview. And there was nothing in the interview, of course, that suggested she didn't do the things she said she did, although she clearly isn't accepting responsibility for it. And then she said stuff, you know, she said stuff about Epstein that didn't make any sense. I have to go back to see it, but there's stuff in there that people who know the record, have been saying is just it's not true. And so what happened with respect to Trump? I mean, I should have selected some stuff to dramatically read, but the upshot basically is she said, I never saw Donald Trump in any circumstance where he did something inappropriate or something like that. Very, very vague. And it's like, okay, is the standard for appropriateness of someone who has been convicted of physically molesting young girls and then of assisting a monster like Epstein and trafficking hundreds of, if not, I think over 1,000 girls for his and other men's sexual pleasure and participating in it. I'm not sure she's a great judge of what is appropriate.
Sure. Yeah. Maybe not a reliable moral arbiter of appropriateness.
I'll just add one more thing and I'll stop blabbing. Lawyers know how to ask questions. Good lawyers know how to ask questions. Like good journalists, but the lawyers are very, very precise. I mean, the way you ask questions is you start general and you go and then you drill down. All right. Have you ever eaten scrambled eggs? What did you have for breakfast today? Isn't it a fact that you had ketchup on your eggs today? You know, that's a very specific question, because if the questions are specific enough and it turns out that the witness lies and then there's a photograph of them eating scrambled eggs, you've got them for perjury. And it's really important here to know what the facts are here, because you can just generally say, oh, I didn't see anything untoward. Okay, but what did you see? He was there. Did you see any young girls there? Oh, well, I mean, what do you mean by young? Under the age of, say, 20 or under the age of 18 or something like that. Those are the kinds of specific questions you would ask. You were actually trying to determine whether somebody did anything inappropriate or was in a circumstance or compromising circumstance where people were doing inappropriate things with minors, by our standards and not the sex trafficker standards. And none of those questions were asked. And, you know, lawyers know how to ask questions to get answers. And they also know how to ask questions not to get the answers they don't want to get. And sometimes you do that. You do that at your peril at a trial, because the other side can show that you're, you know, if you don't bring it out on a direct examination or something, the other side can come and say, oh, Mr. Conway didn't ask you this. Isn't it a fact that, and you say something. So, you know, he was clearly trying to avoid Todd Blanche asking any question specific enough to bring something out. What would that something be?
I don't know. But George, if you add it on top of the press conference yesterday with the victims and the stories that they're telling, and the fact that Congress is trying to have a vote to release more of the DOJ files, and that it would be seen as a hostile act toward the administration for any Republican to vote for it, I like, sometimes I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. I was on Next Level with JVL and Tim yesterday, and we were talking, you know, we were into the political implications of all this. But sometimes, and they were both kind of like, I don't know how big of a deal this is. And I don't know. I like lose my mind. It's like, am I taking crazy pills? The president of the United States is very clearly, they've taken the one person they can get, Ghislaine Maxwell, and given her this cushy, very unusual deal.
Yeah, that no other sex trafficker ever would ever get.
They have the attorney, the deputy attorney general, on purpose going down to interview her to make sure that whatever she says,
who is something Trump's that they criminal can release, defense lawyer,
who is Trump's criminal defense lawyer.
I mean, he's
threatening Republicans to make sure they don't vote for this. In my opinion, you can trace almost everything Donald Trump is doing. And the boys did not agree with this. And maybe I'm being alarmist, but that's not usually my mode. So I'll take being checked on it. But as far as I'm concerned, part of deploying the National Guard to D.C. when there was absolutely not an emergency happening was to change the conversation away from Epstein. And I think lots of the things that Trump is doing, why does he want to redistrict Texas, do a mid-decade redistricting, which totally out of the ordinary, totally unusual. Obviously, he doesn't want any oversight from Congress. He desperately needs Republicans to retain control of Congress so that there's no oversight of him. Like, if you just ask me, I could trace every single thing back to, this is a guy who desperately doesn't want, they just re-released a new round of files.
A new round of old documents.
It's the same ones. Yeah. It's the same ones as before, except with a bunch of new pages that are all completely redacted. How stupid is everybody supposed to be? So just, George, tell me. Maybe you're the wrong person to ask. You're not the one to talk me down.
No, I'm not going to be able to.
Bananas?
I need to have a talk with your boys there. I agree with you. And let me qualify it in a sense. I think there are mixed motives here. I think that a lot of the things that he has been doing are things he was going to get to. And I think he may have front loaded them in part, maybe intentionally create a distraction, or more, I think, instinctively to get attention to himself about something other than Epstein. You've heard my spiel about Trump 10 million times, which is he doesn't think in logical progression. He just spins off and does things impulsively. But those impulses are based upon instincts, and the instinct is, I think he has had this instinct that he needs to attack and attack somewhere else to avoid being attacked himself. And so the way you attack is you go after all the fake enemies that you always otherwise go after. The Democrats, the mayor of Chicago, the mayor of D.C., Gavin Newsom, immigrants, you name it. And so that's his instinct, is to coil up and then strike in some other direction when he feels threatened. And that is not, that's consistent with doing something to distract. But I think I don't think he separates all these things out in his mind. And I think also the pressure that he's feeling because of these files, the fear of being exposed as something, I don't know what it exactly is in these files, I think it makes him more manic. And then I think it also makes the people around him more, they get the understanding that they can get more out of him and they can please him by saying, let's do this, sign this, say that. And I think he gets kind of hyper. And then there's also the aspect here, again, to talk about the mixed motives, I do think he's worried about his own mortality, which is another subject. But I do think, this bit about, I want to go to heaven. And I think he's feeling I think he's feeling pressure in a lot of different ways that's causing him to become more, I don't know if manic is really the right word, but hyper.
So I buy the mixed motive. Like, I buy the idea that he was always going to try to take over the blue cities. But part of it, to me, it is part and parcel of an ongoing pattern of two things. One is, it's always projection, right? So when you say he doesn't necessarily like game it out, I do, but I also think he just like projection is part of what happens with him, right? It's always projection with them. So to distract from his own criminal stuff, he goes after other crime. Like he's like, well, we're going to focus on crime,
the real these crime
criminals. In the cities, right? And you're particularly the criminal. Black ones, people in cities where, you know, like something where he feels like he can get at other people's, like, I'll give you a different enemy to focus on. That's one thing he always does. The other thing is his go-to move always politically is to go to immigrants, right? Like it's the caravans are coming. It's build the wall, right? Like, but just like with Obama, it was Kenyan Muslim
amazing.
Socialists,
the
right?
And the caravans happened to coincide with the run-up to the 2018
election.
Elections.
And then they disappeared. They were an emergency and then they weren't, which is the thing about, right? What he's doing in the cities is declaring emergencies. And my contention is that the emergency part of it is Epstein, right? That it's not an emergency. The only emergency is if it was an emergency for Trump to get a different story going. But I agree with you that there's multiple sort of ways that he's doing it.
Yeah. I mean, the declaration of emergencies is a recurring theme that, you know, some of the decisions that we may talk about or have been talking about, you know, it's all about whether the president's declaration of emergency holds water. And if so, what does it allow him to do? And he has gotten into this position where he has figured out that if he says something is an emergency, he can do whatever he wants. And that could be things he wants to do anyway, or it can be things that distract from things that he's fearful of, or both simultaneously, which I think all of these things are going on at once.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, speaking of other topics we need to get to, we do need to keep moving. But first, we've got an ad, and this show is sponsored by IndieCloud. The only thing growing faster than your inbox is your to-do list. IndieCloud gives you permission to ignore both for a little while anyway. IndieCloud makes federally legal THC. You know where I'm going with this. Gummies, exotic flower, pre-rolls, and vapes built for that sweet spot of relaxation. These gummies are how I'm kicking back these days to clear my head before bed. All of these products are Farm Bill compliant. I don't know what that means, Farm Bill compliant. 100% federally legal, which is important. This stuff is legal now. Third-party tested and shipped discreetly. No sketchy dispensary runs in traffic. I don't think it's sketchy to go to a dispensary, but, you know, if you find it sketchy, these things are discreetly mailed to you. No mystery ingredients, just 50,000 plus happy customers who like their relaxation legal, simple, and delivered. Whatever your vibe, quiet porch nights, book in hand, afternoons, God, I miss those, or a weekend hangout with friends, IndieCloud's got a match that's tested, trusted, and delivered right to your door. Whether you want better focus for that September reset, deeper sleep, which is what I do. I like the gummies, man. They are my sleep go-to. As the days get shorter, or just a peaceful scroll before bed, there's no such thing as a peaceful scroll. This is how grown-ups take the edge off now. So if you're 21 or older, go to indiecloud.co, use code ASKGEORGE for 25% off your first order, plus free shipping. That's IndieCloud. .co, code AskGeorge, 25% off, free shipping, and a better mood showing up right at your door. Take their quick survey when you order to support this show, and thank IndieCloud for making September feel a little lighter. And as always, please enjoy responsibly. Thanks to IndieCloud for sponsoring today's episode. I got to tell you, my producer, though, Connor, when he was, I opened them in the office, and I was like, oh, look, somebody mailed me gummies. And he was like, IndieCloud. He's like, I thought it was a VPN.
I thought it was a VPN sponsor. That's a different sponsor. Yeah.
That's a different sponsor.
You know, it did sound like, yeah, no, IndieCloud, like, you know, you could, it's like storage. Maybe you can store, someday the gummies will be virtually, you know, they'll really be in the cloud. I don't know. But yeah, I keep thinking of IndieCloud. Who was that rap song, IndieCloud, when you said that? IndieCloud. Bump, bump.
Yeah, it is like Inda, INDA.
I've tried
their sleep gummies. I love sleep.
All right.
Sleep is the best. Okay. Back in March, Trump attempted to fire FTC member Rebecca Kelly Slaughter, who was a Biden appointee. You might remember this. She contested her firing because federal law says commissioners can only be removed for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. This week, the D.C. Court of Appeals upheld the district court decision to reinstate Slaughter pending appeal. And so this was interesting because it also has implications for the recent firing of the Federal Reserve Governor, Lisa Cook, which is sort of the most recent firing. So do you take this as a good sign that these, and I'm sorry, actually, before I ask this question, George, I guess I want to say something more broadly about this is, we're going to run through a bunch of good decisions here. Like, I'm about to go through a bunch of appellate court, lower court decisions, all of which
we're the good guys won. Yep.
Are really good. And so part of the reason this is an action-packed episode is because there's a ton of good decisions, lower court decisions in here. But I think I want to add, maybe up front, a note of caution that before, I want to be happy. I want to take happy moments where we get them. The courts are being, are doing a real, like these lower courts are doing, I think, making good decisions. We're only halfway through the game, though. These, most of these were going to get kicked up to the Supreme Court, and that's a different vibe.
Maybe we can rate the decisions based upon, like, gummies. How many gummies do you need you read the opinion? Like, can you? I actually could cut both ways. I mean, you're happy about the decision, you can take a gummy. If you're sad about the decision, you want to go to sleep, you can take a gummy.
You can take a gummy, too.
These are all 10 gummy decisions.
But I want to say, like, do you take this as a good sign? Or are Slaughter and Cook just on borrowed time until their cases hit the Supreme Court?
I take it as a little of both. I just think, obviously, this is not the last stop for this case. And let me just go. We've talked about this before sometime last year or sometime earlier this year. I mean, the short story here about the law in 30 seconds, and you could teach an entire separation of powers law school seminar on this area of law that I'm about to summarize in 30 seconds. Basically, there's the question of what restrictions Congress can place on the president's power to remove the officials who perform executive functions. The strong version of that power has been argued for by conservatives like Justice Scalia and many academics, and I'm pretty sure that Thomas and Alito and Gorsuch and Kavanaugh agree with this. They call it the unitary executive theory, but I don't even think you have to go as far as unitary executive as the way some people use it. Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, which establishes the presidency, says, all it basically says is the executive power of the United States shall be vested. The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States. And so what conservatives have always taken that to mean, or at least taken that to mean the last 40 or 50 years, is the president wields ultimately all executive power. He can delegate some of it and people can act on his behalf, but it's ultimately the president. And in order to do that, the president needs to have an unfettered power to remove people who have that delegated responsibility. And so the question is, can Congress restrict that in any way? And some people say, really, no. But the Supreme Court has taken a different approach over the years. When the FTC was created 100 plus years ago, I don't even remember the year now, but the FTC is an agency that deals with consumer fraud today and deals with antitrust issues. For example, if you want to do a merger, you have to get either approval of the DOJ or the FTC, depending on the circumstances. And the FTC is a so-called independent agency. It was created by Congress, really, to check the power of the president or to make sure that there was antitrust enforcement from administration to administration. And it's a commission of 5 members, of no more than 3 of which can belong to the president's political party, and it has a chairman, and it basically and there are restrictions on the president's ability to fire these individuals. There has to be for cause, and the cause has to be pretty specific under the statute. This was challenged in a case called Humphrey's executor against the United States. And it was really, it was a challenge involving the Federal Trade Commission, the same body, which, exists in largely the same form, although it has more powers today than it did back then. And the Supreme Court basically held that, well, the FTC exercises administrative and judicial functions, right? There are things that you can argue before before FTC administrative law judges and go up to the FTC and they decide, like, whether a merger violates Section 7 of the Clayton Act. And so it's not really executive. And that's what the Supreme Court said back then. Now, that's not really true. The truth of the matter is the Justice Department does a lot of stuff that the FTC does, and the Justice Department reports to the president. This is executive power when the government, when the FTC is the government and says that merger is unlawful. Okay. So, over the years, there's been this inherent tension in the case law. Like, well, we're saying these things, these independent agencies aren't really executive, but they really are. And so what the Supreme Court has done over the years is kind of narrowed Humphrey's executor without overturning it, and basically said that, well, if it's a multi-member body, it's different. Okay. Like, there are all these agencies, the SEC, the FTC, the CFPB, the NTSB, you can name an alphabet soup of agencies that are multi-member agencies. There's no single director, there's a chairman, and there are four members, and they vote on stuff. And so that has been something of an exception to the idea that the executive power has to be exercised by people who can be fired at will by the president. So the rationale of the original decision doesn't really match up today. And there have been the conservatives are critical of that. They're just saying, well, this is a distinction without a difference. What difference does it make whether five people are acting to execute the laws or one person is doing it? One chairman of a commission. Either way, they're exercising presidential executive power under Article 2, Section 1. And that they have to be removable at will by the president. So Humphrey's executive has been perceived by most legal scholars as something as really having a potentially short remaining life. And this was even before Donald Trump came on the scene, even before he was reelected. And now you have a circumstance where people think there's a decent chance the Supreme Court will overrule Humphrey's executor. I don't know whether they're going to do it this year. They may do it this year. They were going to do this, or largely expected to do this. And nobody knows what standard they may come up with, if any, to restrict the president's power. And the problem is, of course, is we're coming at a time where the executive power is being wielded, and the laws are being executed by someone who doesn't want to execute the laws and who doesn't want to exercise executive power consistently with his oath of office. But the problem is here is we have a lunatic who's president who's a criminal. And
a problem.
It's a huge problem. And that's the circumstance we face ourselves and we're faced with. And this case involving the FTC commissioner, it's directly on point with Humphrey's executor. So they basically have to choose in this case when it goes up, if it will. I think it will. Are they going to basically let Donald Trump fire everybody in the government, every executive person wielding executive power, every agency head, everything, or not? And, I don't mind that with the FTC, because I always thought it made no sense to have the DOJ and the FTC together enforcing the same laws. I never really particularly, I was a securities litigator. I don't have fond feelings for the SEC. I think it's necessary to have a securities regulator, but I don't think they're necessarily my favorite agency. And it doesn't make sense why you have U.S. attorneys enforcing the criminal provisions of the securities laws and the SEC doing a completely separate operation enforcing the same laws against the same people civilly. I think it's a mess. On the other hand, it disperses power in a way that is not necessarily bad. And the problem here is, it really expands the power of somebody who's trying to grab so much power. I don't think he knows what to do with it. And he's very dangerous. And then the ultimate example of why you should be scared of this is the Fed. And we're going to get to, obviously, we're going to get to the lawsuit by, you know, Trump has trumped up these charges of mortgage fraud against an FTC commissioner purporting to fire her, the one black woman ever appointed to the Fed.
This is the Federal Reserve. This is Lisa.
The Federal Reserve, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System is the official title of this body. And he wants to remove one of these officials, which in combination with a recent resignation or term expiration would give him control of, you know, his appointees or people favorable to him control of the Fed. And he's a notorious being the real estate debtor and borrower and defaulter and bankruptcy, you know, bankrupt that he is. He loves lowering interest rates, and he loves lowering interest rates just because of his instinct there. And he loves lowering interest rates because perceives it as goosing the economy, and thinks that if interest rates are not reduced, that puts him into political problems. In fact, you know, several years ago, he was attacking Jerome Powell, who he appointed. Even in his first term, he was attacking Jerome Powell. So this is a very, very dangerous thing. And that's the ultimate example of what is the practical danger of him, of Trump getting this power to remove officials. The Fed, you know, the credibility of our monetary system, the credibility of our financial markets depends on the perceived and actual independence of the Federal Reserve System. Just the same way it is with any central bank of a major Western country. And this, you know, they're playing with economic fire here, not just legal fire, but economic fire. And that's sort of, and I think the Supreme Court knows that. I mean, that's the one reason why everybody thinks Humphrey's executive has been left alone all these years, even though it has cracks in it, and even though people criticize it, even though it's kind of contorted, is that, you know, well, geez, what about the Fed? And that's kind of scary.
Well explained. Let's keep going. All right. We got to go to our next one, which is the Posse Comitatus Act.
Yes, Comitatus.
Comitatus. Kuna Matatus. Last week, Andrew Weissman and I
feel like there should be, I feel like there should be Western music when we talk about that law. I don't know why.
Because the posse's
let's
coming?
Let's rope up posses, Sarah. Get them horses out on the road and get them outlaws.
Andrew Weissman and I, who was on last week, who I don't know if you listened to that episode, it was good. We talked about the National Guard deployment in D.C. And of course, Trump had federalized the National Guard in L.A. earlier this summer, and he's threatening to send the Guard to Chicago. And then yesterday he talked about New Orleans, too. There was a multi-day trial last month about whether the Guard has been illegally deployed in L.A. And this week, Judge Breyer, who was the brother of Justice Breyer, Supreme Court Justice Breyer, issued an opinion that started with this, which I'm going to read. Congress spoke clearly in 1878 when it passed the Posse Comitatus Act, prohibiting the use of the U.S. military to execute domestic law. Nearly 140 years later, defendants, President Trump, Secretary of Defense Hegseth, and the Department of Defense deployed the National Guard and Marines to Los Angeles, ostensibly to quell a rebellion and ensure that federal immigration law was enforced. There were indeed protests in Los Angeles, and some individuals engaged in violence. Yet there was no rebellion, nor was civilian law enforcement unable to respond to the protest and enforce the law. The evidence at trial established that defendants systematically used armed soldiers, whose identity was often obscured by protective armor, and military vehicles to set up protective perimeters and traffic blockades, engage in crowd control, and otherwise demonstrate a military presence in and around Los Angeles. In short, defendants violated the Posse Comitatus Act. That feels significant if it's upheld, considering that Trump is talking about, and this, we have to sort of leave aside D.C. because of home rule. There's a lot of complicated reasons why D.C. is different from other cities across the country. But with Trump talking about deploying this to other places, And I have, this is like a question I have. We were talking about it actually on the next level. How significant is it? And will the ruling in LA make them think twice about one of these going into these other cities?
I think it's significant. I think it should be upheld. But again, I thought Judge Breyer's earlier ruling should be upheld. Here's a short description of the bid and ask here, what happened here. So we talked about this a few weeks ago. What happened was, as you mentioned, Trump purports to federalize the California National Guard. And then the question is that lawful? He's not invoking the Insurrection Act. He's invoking some other provision. And just Judge Breyer said, well, this is not, he can't do this. It's not really the kind of the trigger in the statute, which was called number 12406, wasn't really met because it really wasn't an emergency. It was kind of trumped up. And the Ninth Circuit stayed that temporary ruling with an opinion that said, oh, we're not going to second guess the president on what an emergency is. Okay, so that dealt strictly with the question of, and it wasn't after a trial. It was just a preliminary, very on the papers ruling, very, very brief, very quickly done. That dealt with, can the president take command of the state's National Guard? It didn't deal with, well, okay, what can he do with the National Guard once he's taken control of it? And that's the issue that came up in this decision, which occurred after a full trial. And that is, the question is, are they engaged? The Posse Comitatus Act prohibits the use of federal military forces from law enforcement. Now, what does that mean? And they're subject to, there can be exceptions unless Congress actually provides otherwise. And one of the exceptions is the Insurrection Act. And there's no insurrection here. And the government doesn't even claim yet that there's an insurrection. The government made a couple of arguments. The government argued that, well, the statute that allowed him to allowed the president to nationalize the state guard, is an exception to the Posse Comitatus Act, and it isn't. Okay, the judge rejected that. And the other question is, okay, what exactly are these people doing? Are they engaging in law enforcement? And the smoking gun piece of evidence that came up was a slide presentation that was sent around the National Guard or from the Defense Department, or I forget who the recipients were, but it said, here's what the Posse Comitatus Act says. You can't do the following X number of things. And let me pull it up. Okay, this is Breyer's opinion. And in the middle of the opinion, he puts this slide in. This slide was part of training materials given to Force 51, which was the California National Guard that was federalized. And it says the PCA, the Posse Comitatus Act, prohibits active direct pursuit, arrest, apprehension, search, seizure, secure, and there are four things in red: security patrols, traffic control, crowd control, and riot control. And then evidence collection, interrogation, informant. Okay. What this slide says is these things in red are prohibited by the Posse Comitatus Act. Okay. The government concedes it is doing those four things, and you can see video of them doing those four things. And their argument was, well, the Constitution Article 2 creates a constitutional exception here. And there is no constitutional exception for that. So essentially, by the lights of the government's own PowerPoint here, they were violating the Posse Comitatus Act. And that basically is the core of the decision. And so the real question is going to be, I think, on appeal, I don't think there's any question about what they are doing and whether or not it is law enforcement. I think the question is going to become a purely legal question of whether Section 12406, the provision that authorizes the president to federalize the National Guard, creates an exception for the Posse Comitatus Act. And I don't think it does. I don't think there's any way that the governor should win that, but who knows?
Okay. So I did look up Posse Comitatus, and it is a Latin phrase meaning the power of the county. and refers to the traditional legal concept that a sheriff or other law officer can call upon citizens to assist in maintaining peace or apprehending criminals.
Yep.
In the United States, the phrase is also known for the Posse Comitatus Act, a federal law passed in 1878 that prohibits the use of the U.S. military for domestic law enforcement purposes, with certain exceptions authorized by Congress or the Constitution. So that all makes sense, right? It makes sense.
That all makes sense. It makes sense. It's why I keep thinking of the Western music. Well, Sheriff Long Whale, she's getting a posse together to ride out. We're going to ride out at dawn to get them cattle rustlers that we have been causing a real harm to our cattlemen.
Who knew that rounding up a posse was Latin? It was like came from had a Latin derivation.
They had horses there, but they were wearing togas. I don't know. Whatever.
I think that's the Greeks. I don't know. Speaking of the clothing that people wear, I saw this ad on Instagram for the Perfect Jean, making some very extreme claims.
Perfect Jean,
like
Perfect Jean.
Said, I can't see your. There we go. Look how perfect they look.
Perfect jeans.
They say they're the most comfortable jeans ever, that they fit your body perfectly, that it stretches for days.
Yes.
These are men's jeans.
Oh my gosh.
This is the patriarchy at work. So, George,
tell us
why you
love. And they're here in New
York.
They're probably just a few blocks away.
Oh, yeah, because it's in there. It's in there.
I'm in the East Village right now. Yeah, it's Perfect Jeans NYC.
All right. So, how do they compare to your old jeans? What do you like about them?
They don't compare at all. These are just comfortable. I mean, they feel like, you know, they're as comfortable as sweatpants. And you can make them tighter or looser. They're different cuts. And it comes in basically every conceivable size you can imagine, like basically by the inch, you know, waist and length. Again, with the different cuts, it's like there is no they're all comfortable, but you can make them as comfortable as you want. And they just, they're great.
Yeah, right. It's no sucking in the gut or the button zipper battle. No more chafing, no more flat ass or otherwise unflattering fits. If you're hard to fit, they have waist, to your point, from 26 to 50 and lengths from 26 to 38. So the Perfect Jean always has free shipping. Free exchanges and returns. You can have peace of mind knowing that your order is completely risk-free. It's funny, the guys here, one of our producers, has like four pairs of these Perfect Jeans now. There's a lot of Perfect Jeans going on the men at the Bulwark staff after hearing this. So be like them. Head to theperfectjean.nyc. Our listeners get 15% off your first order, plus free shipping, free returns, and free exchanges when you use code ASKGEORGE15 at checkout. That's 15% off for new customers at theperfectjean.nyc with promo code ASKGEORGE15. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. George Conway's jeans sent you. But fuck your khakis and get the Perfect Jean. There, I swore. Hate doing that. But that's the tagline. So Harvard, I didn't want to miss this one with you because you and I've talked about Harvard a couple times. And I remember when you were so glad that they were doing, you know, they were giving pushback to the administration, you sent them money for the first time. Well, in another big district court opinion this week, a federal judge ruled that the administration's attempts to freeze more than $2 billion in federal research grants to Harvard University was illegal. The judge wrote, "Review of the administrative record makes it difficult to conclude anything other than that defendants used anti-Semitism as a smokescreen for a targeted, ideologically motivated assault on this country's premier universities." Which is, you know, here's the thing, because Harvard's been wobbling lately, right? They've been looking like they're going to maybe give in on some of these things.
We don't know where those stories have been coming from.
That's
it
true.
Could be. You know, I mean, I assume it's sourced well, but of course, the administration has every reason to kind of leak that they're making progress because it makes them look powerful and puts pressure on Harvard. But yeah, I mean, it's been upsetting to see these news stories, particularly in the New York Times, reported by some very good journalists like Michael Schmidt, that said that they were making progress to settle. And it was upsetting to me as a Harvard alum who recently gave a lot of money to Harvard because they were fighting back, to read those stories, I start getting this pit in my stomach. And it's a, and one of the reasons why it was so maddening is somebody's got to fight these people. Somebody's got to stand up for their rights, because if Harvard can't do it, then no other university is going to do it. Well, why should anybody else? The other aspect of it is that, how do I put this? What makes it worse is it's a no-brainer of a case. I mean, the government is not even pretending to really be serious about the anti-Semitism contention. Okay. And not because most of what it's asking for is not, doesn't have anything to do with anti-Semitism or what happened at Harvard during the Gaza protests a couple of years ago. And Judge Burroughs, the district judge in Massachusetts in Boston, who wrote this opinion, just wrote a fabulous opinion and just went through the evidence, including tweets of, or truths of a certain person, the president of the United States, where it's like, okay, is this really about fighting discrimination or anti-Semitism under Title VI, the law that prohibits universities from engaging in discrimination on the basis of religion or whatnot? He's talking about, you know, he's having these outrageous screeds in all caps. They hired left-wing Democrats like Lori Lightfoot and just sort of attacking them for being left-wing, which is like, okay, you don't like their politics. Okay, you're, some of the things that you're asking for have nothing to do. Most of the things they're asking for have nothing to do with politics. It's about you want to have more intellectual diversity on the faculty. Now, I want more intellectual diversity on any faculty. I'm good with that. But the government can't do that, because the government doing that is a violation of the First Amendment. And it's just that it was just a no-brainer. And that's the reason why I was just so upsetting to hear suggestions that Harvard would cave. Although, you know, Harvard has reasons to, because it's like fighting, you know, it's like you're bleeding while you fight, even if you get these stays. You know, people, there's just all this uncertainty overhead, and they wanted to have certainty.
Yeah, but here's the thing I wanted to ask you about. So they win. They've just won, right, this big district court opinion, and says that the administration can't freeze the billions of dollars of committed federal funds. And it just seems to me that most people who stand their ground, like the law firms that, yes, stood their ground and fought Trump, Harvard, when it stands its ground and fights Trump, anybody who fights him in court, they're winning. So, like, why? Yep.
Hello, Paul Weiss. Are you out there?
At least
in the blocks north of here. Yeah.
At least in the lower courts, they're winning. Yes. So why isn't this?
They're going to win in the Supreme Court too. There is no reasonable construction of the factual record. I mean, the government here is basically brazenly threatening and bullying Harvard to engage in political choices that Harvard doesn't want to make. And you just can't do that under the First Amendment. It doesn't matter whether it's a university. It doesn't matter whether it's the bulwark. It's just, you cannot do that. And there's no way that this decision would not be affirmed on appeal, including by the Supreme Court of the United States. So, okay, so the question is, what does that mean? In terms of, will Harvard try to settle now? I think in some ways it could make it harder for Harvard and other universities to settle. And note that when these four law firm injunctions were issued, the Trump administration actually went away and stopped bothering law firms, and the law firms started, you know, getting their backs up. So maybe that could be a positive. On the other hand, Harvard could think, well, you know, we're still going to end up with myriad fights because these guys never take no for an answer. And maybe what we can do is we can talk them down money-wise and talk them down in terms of some of the restrictions that they seem to be insisting on that infringe upon our academic rights, and just pay them off once and be done with them. And that, you know, that might be a normal thinking process if you were dealing with normal people, trustworthy people on the other side, but they're not. Okay, they're dealing with a mob organization. The governor in the United States, run by the chief orange mobster, and you can't trust them. They'll come back at you with something else. And unless it's, you know, airtight, I guess the Harvard thinking would be like, we'll get it into a consent decree issued by, so ordered by a federal judge. It's like, Harvard, you know, I just hope they just don't settle. I think they have the upper hand. They've always had the upper hand, And I think the damage that would be done to Harvard as an institution and to higher education in the United States generally, and to the rights of all of us who want to stand up to abusive government and government that seeks to impose its political views on everyone, I think Harvard needs to do that and take one for the team, but it's not taking a big one for the team because it's going to win.
Yeah. I mean, the lesson here is you can fight back. And also, like I said up top, the law is still working to some degree. Like, I know we all feel like nothing matters and this guy's just ignoring the law, but like, there's still, in some cases, like in the TikTok case, like there are places where they're, but they're not acting like the law doesn't exist, right? They're still
They aren't acting as if the laws. I mean, I've been warning for months. I've been expressing a fear, which has only somewhat come to pass, that they're going to violate court orders, right? And that they're, but more important, that they're going to intentionally violate court orders and basically say, "F the courts," the way Emil Bobe told people at the Justice Department, "F the courts." My fear has always been that he will basically say, "Fuck the courts. We're not going to obey anybody." He hasn't quite done that yet, although they have been doing things to try to avoid compliance with judicial rulings by lying to courts, gaslighting to courts, trying to misreading court orders, doing shit in the middle of the night so that nobody can go to court to stop them. They've been doing all that stuff. Now, the people who have been doing just an absolutely fantastic job in keeping the rule of law alive are the district court judges, the federal district court judges of the United States. Hundreds of women and men of both political parties, some appointed by Donald Trump, even, they have been standing up and saying, "This is the law. You can't do this. You can't ignore the law. You can't make these disingenuous arguments. You're insulting us by making these disingenuous arguments." The one court that hasn't done quite as good a job, has done a good job, and other times it's like, "What are they doing?" is the Supreme Court of the United States. And one of the things that's happened, the Supreme Court, a couple of the justices have been critical of lower court justices, and particularly in one Massachusetts case involving the resettlement of refugees to a third country, some of them feel that district courts are just defying them or want to defy them, the court. And Judge Burroughs, in this Harvard decision, wrote this amazing footnote where he says, "Look, we're trying to get the law right. We're working hard. We're working late nights, essentially. And you are just issuing these decisions, Supreme Court, that we can't even make sense out of. You're not explaining yourselves. You're not even agreeing amongst yourselves. And so don't criticize us. We're just trying to get the job right. If you want us to do what you want us to do, tell us what that is." It's a remarkable footnote. A footnote 8, I commend it to all you lawyers out there, people who like to read footnotes. And that is sort of a theme that we're starting to see with federal district judges generally. We saw it with the Boasberg judicial complaint, where Boasberg was expressing, in a judicial conference, Judge Boasberg was expressing to the Chief Justice concerns that district courts have, that, government isn't following orders, and we need backup here. And there was an article on an NBC News website last night about how, like, the reporter interviewed 10 federal judges on back, unnamed, and 10 federal district judges, and they're saying, "We don't think the Supreme Court has our back, and they're not helping us. They're not basically the same criticism that Judge Burroughs put in her opinion. And then it happened again in the FTC case that we talked about 40 minutes ago now. In that case, the government was essentially arguing that it should win and be able to, the Trump should be able to fire the FTC commissioner, notwithstanding Humphrey's executor, which is a case that directly on point says the president can't do that. And one of the things that the court, it was a 2-1 decision. There was a Trump judge from Trump 1 who dissented. But one of the things in that order that the majority on the panel pointed out, it was like, "You if you, the government is asking us to defy the Supreme Court, which is like, the Supreme Court doesn't want us to do that. They just told us, don't defy us. Yeah. And here's their existing precedent that they haven't bothered to try to overturn in 8 decades. So it's a very, very interesting byplay. The tension between the Supreme Court of the United States, which has the 6-3 quasi-Trumpian majority, not quite all there, and these district judges. And there's another aspect of this, which I think is sort of not been written about enough. The Supreme Court justices, I mean, they're lawyers. They've been law professors, some of them. Some of them have been appellate advocates. There really aren't justices on there. I have to think carefully. I don't think Kavanaugh has ever tried a case. I don't think Roberts has ever tried a case. I know Thomas has never tried a case. I could be wrong. Alito was a prosecutor, so he knows he could have been. He knows how to try a case. And Gorsuch has never tried a case. I don't think Gorsuch was a real practicing lawyer. I don't know. Maybe I could be wrong there. He was on the Tenth Circuit for a long time. It's like, they don't know how they're not good at dealing with things that are roughly packaged. Okay. And when a court case comes to court and it's an emergency case, it's like, you don't necessarily know what all the facts are. You don't, legal issues are being identified, new ones every day, because the lawyers are thinking up new stuff as they go along, and then events change. It's a messy thing to delve into. If you are an appellate court, two levels above the district court where all the fact finding is happening, and you're a multi-member court where you have 9 people who can think 9 different things about what's going on, and they could all be wrong and they could all be right. So, and it was really surprising in a recent decision where, there was a 4-1-4 split, the libs plus Roberts. And then the 4 other Republican appointees other than Barrett, and then Barrett. And essentially, Barrett's opinion controlled, because the rule is that the narrowest vote determines the rule when everyone disagrees. And her opinion controlled, even though 8 justices disagreed with her. What's the district court supposed to do with that? It's just a mess. And the Supreme Court has made it worse because they don't know what they're doing here. Okay. They don't know what they're doing here because they're not experienced with expedited litigation. They're not trial lawyers. They're used to working on well-developed records where the issues have been narrowed to one issue. That's when they do their job the best. Doing things in the middle of the night on weekends is not their thing. Particularly since they've never, like most of them, have never, ever tried a case in a federal district court. And I got to say, these opinions written by Judge Breyer, Judge Burroughs, these are great. These people are every bit as smart and every bit as talented, if not more, than some of these justices. And I think we all need to stick up for them.
Yes. Great. Great. Okay. All right, we got to keep moving. We're an hour deep. This show is sponsored by Dupe.com. Have you ever fallen in love with a couch, lamp, or rug online? I know you thought I was going somewhere different. I know you did. Have you ever fallen in love with a couch, George? Don't answer that. Okay.
And I live near somebody who does.
But you fall in one online. Like, you're looking at furniture, you fall in love online, and then your soul leaves your body when you see the price tag. I'm going to let you in on a little secret. It's called Dupe.com. It's really easy to use. All you have to do is type DUPE.com/ before any product URL, and it instantly shows you similar and more affordable alternatives. Here's the thing I love about Dupe.com, and because I love being thrifty, I'm still a fiscal conservative, but I don't want it at the expense of quality, right? You want the stuff to be nice. And these aren't sketchy knockoffs they're selling. What most people don't realize is that the furniture sold online is mass produced in the exact same factories. Those factories then sell the brands under different names, who then list them for different prices. Dupe.com automatically lists these less expensive alternatives for you, so you're not overpaying for the same brand. Dupe is one of the most viral shopping hacks on TikTok, which I'm not on. So I had to find out about it a different way. But millions of people have already used Dupe to save money, and it's 100% free to use. That $5,000 cloud sofa you don't think you can justify? The beautiful mid-century dresser you've bookmarked forever? You've had it bookmarked like for months? Just not sure if you can pull the trigger? Dupe will find a similar item, sometimes even the same item, for 60, 70, or 80% off. With Dupe.com, you can finally decorate the house of your dreams without going broke. Nobody wants to go broke right now. World's too uncertain. Dupe.com isn't just about furniture either. Dupe works for fashion, shoes, jewelry, and more. Dupe.com is really so easy to use. Just type dupe.com/ before any product URL in your browser, and boom, it instantly finds you less expensive alternatives. They even have an app and a browser extension you can download. No account required, no sign-up required. It's completely free to use. Stop wasting money on brand names and start saving with Dupe.com today. Thanks, Dupe. All right. Last week, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit upheld a decision striking down Trump's tariffs back in May. And on Wednesday, the administration petitioned the Supreme Court for very expedited review, which is funny because if the administration is claiming this is an emergency now, even though the original decision was back in May and it's been working its way through the appellate process, like why do they need this emergency now?
I have not had the opportunity to read the government's petition for certiorari, which was literally filed late last night on the same, you know, not long after this Federal Circuit decision came down this week. And what, when you see a cert petition that's filed within hours or days of a decision, it tells you one thing. The government knew it was going to lose. And the government has known it was going to lose in the Federal Circuit. It knew it was going to lose in the Court of International Trade. And obviously this is going to go to the Supreme Court and they're going to have to take it. And the question is, how quickly are they going to take it? The legal issue, we've talked about it before. It's under the International Economic Emergency something act of I forget what year. But basically what it comes down to is it allows, you know, it's an offshoot of something that was called the Trading with the Enemy Act. It basically allows the, you know, if there's a political crisis in the world, military crisis or something like that, it allows the government to say, well, we're not going to import stuff from the Soviet Union, or we're not going to import stuff from these bad actors of this country we're not having good relations with. And it talks about regulating stuff. It doesn't talk about taxes. It doesn't mention tariffs. And the government's position is, well, the power to regulate includes power to issue tariffs. And the Federal Circuit, like the court below, did a very good job of rebutting that. And it came up with a very, very good analogy, which really was stuck in my head. And when it talked about the SEC, what does the SEC do? The SEC regulates securities trading on Wall Street. Okay. By the logic used by the government here, that power to regulate, because I'm sure it says there's the word regulate must be somewhere in the securities laws because they could pass trading rules and whatnot. And so does the Commodities Futures Trading Act. Does that mean that appropriate regulation could include, well, we're going to impose a 1% tax on all stock trading on the New York Stock Exchange, or 1% tax on all commodities trading on the CBOE? No, that would be bizarre. And, you know, and Congress, when Congress wants to talk about taxes, and Congress has the sole power to impose taxes under Article 1 of the Constitution, it says so. And that's basically a simple point of the decision. Now, the Supreme Court is going to get the last word on this. And I think the question is going to be, how quickly will they do it? I think the government will ultimately lose, I hope. The real question is, how quickly are they going to do it? And this, the Federal Circuit did something interesting here to take the pressure off a little bit. They stayed their own decision. They didn't say that the tariffs must immediately cease, even though they could have done that. So maybe that's going to allow the court to take this on a less expedited basis, which I think probably would be better because, as I said, I think they do better when they take more time with things, although that's not always the case, e.g. Trump versus the United States. But again, this is going to go up to the Supreme Court of the United States. I think the only argument, and again, I haven't read the cert petition, that the government could make about how, you know, how it's being harmed here is if the government, if these tariffs are struck down after, you know, 6 more months or a year or something like that, I think they have to refund. Somebody could bring a lawsuit. People are going to, hundreds of people, thousands of people can bring lawsuits saying we want our money back, importers. And that would be kind of bad for the Treasury, which is, you know, lacking in funds because we cut taxes more than we cut spending. Yeah. And are, I mean, running this, up a this huge
is
just
this issue is debt. is like pretty straightforward in terms of this. Now is in, now we got to go up to the Supreme Court. It continues to be a business environment in which nobody knows what's going on, right? Like, and that's just an impossible business environment. I am shocked that it is not reflected more in the markets. Like, I don't know why this level of uncertainty doesn't seem to be spooking them more, but this level of uncertainty is high. All right, George, close it in. We're coming into the home stretch here. Okay.
It's almost tomorrow already.
I know. There's going to be
probably you check.
There's
going to
be more decisions. Yeah. There's going to be more decisions while we're taping. I want to talk about immigration before we get out of here. I want to talk about a few of the cases that involve removal of undocumented people from the United States. So at 4 a.m. on Sunday morning of Labor Day, right? It's Labor Day weekend. It's the Sunday of a holiday weekend. A D.C. judge issued an emergency order halting the Trump administration from sending more than 600 unaccompanied Guatemalan children back to their home country. According to lawyers for the children, the administration is preparing to send them back to Guatemala without notice or a chance to contest their deportation. The government says that all the kids have guardians in Guatemala, but the lawyers for the kids say that isn't true in all cases. And without any sort of hearing, I'm not sure how the government would know which kids have family in Guatemala and which don't. I got to say, man, with the kids, like, the cruelty is, I don't know, man. When you
off the charts.
I've got kids. The thought of this, I don't know. I can't. I sort of can't think.
There used to be a bipartisan consensus that we need to help kids and take care of them and not abuse them. Used to be.
Yeah, but I mean, just like the thought of a child trying to navigate our immigration system in this way.
Well, that's why there's a law, actually, which was an issue there. So, I mean, look, what happened
tell me about this case.
No, what happened there is that this case, they decided to do this on a weekend, hoping that they could slip these kids out of the country without getting enjoined. The plaintiffs, I guess, I think the groups included the ACLU, filed something late on, I guess, was it Friday night? And essentially, the judge got woken up in the middle of the night, and she said in the hearing the next morning that she had been up since 2:30 and that her law clerks had been up since 2:30 because they had to actually read the briefs and do some research and to figure out, like, okay, what is going on here in the middle of the night? And the upshot was the government, you know, the government came in and had nothing really to say about what was legal, how this could be legal. And it couldn't be legal because there is something called, because we love kids, there is something called the Torture Victims Protection Reauthorization Act of 2008. And, you know, it deals with torture victims in part, but it also deals with refugee children. It says there's provisions in there in the TVPRA of 2008 passed during a Republican administration. As I said, back when there was a consensus that we should, you know, help kids. It says that if any unaccompanied minor is in the United States, a bunch of things, protections kick in. One is they have to be held by something called the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Okay, they can't be held in a normal INS, whatever, or Alcatraz, or anything like that, or anything you could possibly create. There is a specific agency that is designed to help refugees resettle in the United States, and they're basically nice to people. I'm surprised they still have funding. Maybe they don't.
I think they've been busy settling white Afrikaners.
Oh, right. I forgot about that. Yeah. So the OR has to keep custody of these. So ultimately, the order was send them back to the ORR. But anyway, that's one protection they get. Another protection is they get full removal protections, removal hearings. You have to have a full hearing. No expedited shortcuts, no nothing. It says they get a full hearing. Not only that, the government has to find them counsel and pay for it. Okay, so you can't put kids in the middle of the night on an expedited basis, just take their cases off the immigration docket, not give them lawyers, put them on a plane and send them back to Guatemala. It specifically violates multiple provisions of the TVPRA. And it was a no-brainer. But, the funny thing is the judge wasn't taking any risk here with the government. You know, she was just basically saying, you understand what this means. ORR, you have to take the kids off those planes and put them back at the ORR. Do you understand me? No more kids will be sent to planes, and certainly nobody leaves the country. Basically, do you understand me? I mean, essentially, that's what the judge had to do. And then what happened after the decision was actually equally appalling. The MAGAs started attacking this judge because she is an immigrant.
Yeah, she's from Trinidad and Tobago.
Okay.
So Stephen Miller tweeted about her, calling her a Democrat and implying that because she's foreign born, she is untrustworthy.
Right. And there was a bunch of social media commentary from the racist right about that, including a tweet from Laura Loomer that said, I won't even say what it said. And I responded to her. I think I responded to that tweet. That wasn't the tweet. There was a tweet online that basically said the framers didn't intend for foreign-born judges to be telling the president of the United States what to do. Right? I don't remember who tweeted that out. And I quote tweeted and I said, 51 of the 85 Federalist Papers were written by a guy from Nevis.
Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah.
Not to mention, I didn't you tweet this, though? What I thought you were going to say was, isn't Aileen Cannon not born in the United States?
Oh, right. MAGA's favorite judge. Yeah, that was Loomer attacked the judge in the TVPRA case, and I responded like, "Yeah, we absolutely have to get rid of all these foreign-born judges." And I posted a picture from Wikipedia, a screenshot from Wikipedia of Aileen Cannon and her bio, a summary that said she was born in Cali, Colombia.
Not in the United States. Interesting.
Yeah.
Why should this
foreign-born judge have the right? I mean, she was a citizen at birth because her father, I think, was from Indiana. But let's leave that aside. Why should this foreign-born woman from Colombia, born in Colombia, have the right to say that the president of the United States gets to steal classified documents? Where does it say that? Where did the framers intend that?
This is a whole different podcast that we could do. And we did a lot of it on TNL, but like, the Blood and Soil tribe here is really out in force. They were all over the National Conservatism Conference. I can't. It is wild how quickly this has taken root.
I
mean, it's been around forever, but like the zeal and the lack of shame now. I mean, our friend Greg Nunziata had a tweet that it was like, I think he said it's as dangerous as it is un-American, this thing, which is completely true. Ooh. Yes, completely.
The Aryan workers are. It's crazy.
Where did all your grandparents come from, guys? Laura Loomer. Are they Native American? You tell me. Jeez, this is ridiculous. Okay, last one. This week, the Fifth Circuit, probably the most conservative federal court of appeals in the country, ruled against the administration in its use of the Alien Enemies Act to summarily deport a group of Venezuelan immigrants. Trump claimed they were members of the street gang Tren de Aragua. Yeah, this case has already made its way up to the Supreme Court and is probably headed back to the Supreme Court after this. What say you?
I mean, it's absolutely correct decision by this panel of the Fifth Circuit. We've talked about this case before when the district judge issued the injunction. This is about the Alien Enemies Act, which allows the president in times of war and invasion to remove aliens from the country that invaded us or we are at war with. So, for example, Germany. The Germans were deported in under the Alien Enemies Act in World War II. And here, you know, the contention that there was an invasion or war is absurd. They're just a bunch of people who came to the United States that may or may not be narco-terrorists or something, or narco-whatever. It's not clear that the government doesn't have a great track record on identifying these people, frankly, at this point. But it's not an invasion when a bunch of people show, some people show up at LAX, some people show up on the border, you know, some people show up at IAH, some people show up at JFK, and they live in separate communities, and they do whatever they're doing that the government doesn't like, if anything. That's not what's meant by an invasion, okay? And it's not, and these people are not representing the government of Venezuela, which we may go to war with anyway, because we're doing something else that's illegal with, you know, they bombed this alleged drug boat. But that's, we could do a whole program on that too.
And we'll have to do it next time, because I swear to God, we've been at this for too long.
It's crazy.
Too long.
And there's probably a couple things we forgot about. I don't even
know. There are, but I got to say, I tried to get in most of the things you've been texting me over the course of this week, but I want to sort of wrap up by saying there's a lot of good news in here. There's just a lot of the people who are feeling helpless, people who have been feeling dejected, people who are feeling like the law, you know, isn't doing enough to protect us. Like, there's a lot that it is doing. This administration is being held at bay. They aren't summarily ignoring the courts yet. But also, people shouldn't get too excited, because this Supreme Court has not, you know, it's been a little bit all over the place. It's not to be trusted as a purely good faith interpreters of the Constitution. And like, they're going to look for ways to give Trump what he wants. But it will be interesting to watch all of these proceed when the court is back. But I think they sit in October, and we'd probably get decisions in November, December on some of these.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They come back in October, and I mean, we don't know what this, they're going to be issuing emergency orders between now and then. They'll probably issue a bunch in October. And then the question is, are they going to take some actual merits cases for argument, including, for example, that AEA case is probably going to go en banc to the Fifth Circuit. But then there are some other cases kicking around, like the firing of the FTC commissioner and the tariffs case in particular. So they're going to be some actual, this is going to be a big term at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, big term. So we got a lot that you and I are going to be following in terms of the legal and illegal news. But George, thanks as always for talking all this through
with
us.
It's great to see you again, Sarah.
It's great to see you, my friend. Guys, don't forget to hit subscribe, leave us a review, and we're going to see you next week.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand, explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption too. The legal tangles and troubles, they're growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last and last. Oh, Conway, tell Longwell all about it. Those legal problems can't live without it. From the Ebola mess to the Russian ties. Oh, Sarah, listen close.